Hello, this is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for an off-campus conversation. I think we've been doing off-campus conversations now for like 2 years, maybe 2 years and a smidge, but typically they have only involved two parties. This is a rare occasion in which the off-campus conversation involves three parties. So I'm very delighted to be joined by Professors Koons and Bonnevac from the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Hey, it's my joy. So folks will know you from your various publications in philosophy of science and in natural theology, or just from the kind of splendor or radiance of glory which issues from the University of Texas and all of its school programs. Is it still the case that there's a program there called Plan 2?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I remember thinking that's a cool liberal arts program, and that is the most subversive way to name it.
Right.
So kudos to you guys. But for those who don't know you or your work, would you each say just a word of introduction?
Sure. So we've both been at UT for a long time now. I've been 37 years. You're
44.
44. So, and we've been good friends all that time. Although I don't know if we've really collaborated or anything before this, have we?
A few things, but not much.
Nothing like a major project. We're working together on a book on the five ways, Thomas's Aquinas's five ways. We have a pretty complete draft now. I was working on the introduction and conclusion. Yeah, we're both sort of hard to pin down in terms of specialization. We tend to do a little of everything.
We're dilettantes, basically.
Physics, philosophy of nature, in my case. Both of us done some work on philosophical logic.
Right, exactly. And I've done some work on ethics, and especially the combination of logic and ethics, studying moral reasoning.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm hoping I aspire to be a dilettante as well, so that at every opportunity when specialization is foisted upon me as an urgent need, I can effectively sidestep or swim move or do whatever football move I've been practicing to that point. So I look forward to a life of similarly, well, I don't know if I'll ever go as deep as you do on any subjects. I don't know if I can make an apt comparison. Okay, so nevertheless, you're working on a project on the five ways, and there might be people who hear that and think, you mean to tell me that 750 years after the fact, people are still working on the five ways, and then they might hearken to a word from Ecclesiastes or other wisdom authors, you know, to the effect that there's nothing new under the sun, and they might despair of the positive fruits of your labors and then interest them themselves in other things. To that unsympathetic listener and or reader, what's novel about the approach, or why is it worthwhile to continue to pursue this line of inquiry?
I mean, one thing we discovered as we worked on this is that it's surprising actually how little has been done in the last 750 years on these five arguments, given the centrality of them to Thomas's work and to the history of philosophy. I mean, there are a lot of people who have written long books on Thomas's philosophy, but generally a few pages, maybe a shortish chapter on all the five ways. So there's relatively little where people have dug into it. I think what we bring to the project is maybe three or four things that are sort of unique. In the sense that, well, first of all, we both know the original languages, so we can look at the Latin and Greek. At the same time, we've got pretty good training in the logic, contemporary logic, so we're good at extracting arguments, and we know the analytic, metaphysical, contemporary scene. And finally, we're sympathetic to Thomas. We come to it with the assumption that this is a great mind, and so it's very common, actually, even among Thomists, to attribute to Thomas logical howlers, fallacies, circular reasoning, and so on, confusions of various kinds. And also to think that the arguments are somehow dependent on outdated astronomy, mechanics, cosmology, and so on. And our working hypothesis has been that that's not the case, that Thomas is presenting these arguments as things that proceed from some self-evident premises, that he was well aware of the difference between something that's self-evident and philosophy and something that's a speculative theory of mechanics or cosmology, and he wouldn't have been relying on those kinds of, potentially outdated parts of his science of the day.
Nice. Well, maybe at some point in the conversation we could get to the question of subsisting fire, which people lose their minds over.
Yeah,
but right. The fourth way is probably that reason which makes least sense to the contemporary mind. Maybe it's just, well, never mind. I'll just move on from that. When you kind of approach the five ways, you see in the five ways a kind of approach to reality. Some people call it existential. Some people call it phenomenological. Some people invent words so as to describe it. What is the disposition with which one begins or kind of onboards the five ways?
Well, I mean, they're arguments. We think they're arguments, you know, for God's existence, ultimately. They're the initial steps of a pretty long project that takes up much of the first part. So you can't just read the five ways and think that the project natural theology has been done. It's just the beginning steps, but it's nonetheless crucial steps. I mean, I guess our bias is towards a more metaphysical or philosophy of nature perspective on the arguments, as opposed to thinking of them as purely phenomenological or something like that. They're about the real world, for sure.
Right. For those who aren't familiar with the five ways, each one is about a paragraph long.
Yeah.
So you can't really blame some commentators for just devoting a couple of paragraphs to an argument that doesn't take up much space.
Yeah.
And looking at it in isolation, there are a lot of objections that people can raise. But one of the things we've found is that for the last 100 years or more, the translations of the five ways into English or even some other languages are really misleading.
Yeah.
They get things backwards. They aren't paying attention to how Thomas uses specific Latin terms there and in other works. And so it in many cases just makes people think the argument is about something other than what it's really about.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the fourth way. Actually, there's a critical place there where the standard translation is, we think, exactly the opposite of what Thomas is trying to say. We went back to Aristotle's Greek. And Aristotle is saying something that is really the converse of what the translation suggests. And if you take that seriously, you're going to just mistake the entire argument. And it's going to look not only bad, but completely puzzling. It will look like he concludes with something that shouldn't be the conclusion. And the whole thing looks question-begging. But we found that to be the case in the third way as well. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, in the fifth way, which people often mistakenly think of as a design argument. And if you think of it that way, it's the worst design argument in the world, but that's not what it is.
Very clearly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people not look at sources. So as they say, in the fourth way explicitly refers to Aristotle's metaphysics, and you have to look at that particular passage. People just don't do that typically, which is kind of surprising. Likewise, the third way relies on some things in Maimonides, and again, you need to trace that back. So there's a lot of failure to kind of to do the spade work, I guess you could say, to figure out, you know, what's going on in these arguments.
Yeah, in my dissertation, I was studying exemplar causality, and obviously, maybe not obviously, but somewhat obviously, the fourth way features in a lot of the secondary literature apropos of how we speak of the exemplar as a cause, because some people take it that in the first half of the fourth way, St. Thomas kind of gets done what he needs to get done, and then the second half of the fourth way is just, well, you know, while we're here, we may as well do this and that and the other thing and yada, 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 and such. So that for me was, I don't know if exciting the word, painstaking is probably the more accurate word whereby to describe any process of discovery that's part of your doctoral dissertation project. But yeah, I can sympathize with the type of archaeology, paleontology, that might be required in any effort of this sort. Okay, well then, maybe we just kind of start with certain things that emerge organically from the first way, which I think a lot of people would say is available to the natural philosopher, in the sense that he's looking at ens mobile and trying to make sense of what it is that transpires under his nose. What might be some of the types of mistaken readings or conceptual obstacles posed by misinterpretation of the first way that you'd like to put in its place or set aside entirely?
Right, so the first way is, of course, about the cause of motion, right, and how it is. Thomas is claiming that there has to be a prime mover, an unmoved mover, responsible ultimately for all motion. Now, what most people do is interpret this in terms of a kind of mechanical necessity. That is, as if there were a set of gears in the world, so to speak. And for the final gear to be turning, simultaneously, somebody's got to be turning that first gear, so to speak, right? And so then the objection is, the standard objection, the first way is, this is just outdated mechanics, right? So once you bring in the principle of inertia, then you can have just things just keep moving, right, on their own. They don't need a simultaneous thing kind of pushing them along at each point. That's the sort of standard interpretation. There's a number of things wrong with that. One is, again, it would make the argument depend not on the obvious fact that there's change, but on the very unobvious theory that that change requires a simultaneous gear cranker out there somewhere, right? As though, and one of the things, of course, very confusing is that if you look at Thomas and Aristotle's discussion of things like violent motion of projectiles, like an arrow, they do sort of suggest that there has to be something like the air pushing the arrow along at each moment. And it's easy to take that and say, okay, that's what's going on in the first way. That's the assumption that's underlying the first way. And I think that that's clearly wrong. First of all, there are lots of areas in Aristotle and in Thomas where things like inertia are already present. There's already a kind of impetus in things. Number of places. Two most obvious would be the motion, the natural motion of substances. So a rock falling down, for instance, moving towards its natural place. It doesn't need something pushing it along at each moment. It's just its nature is to go towards the center of the earth. Likewise, the rotation of the heavenly spheres. There's not really any need for anything to keep pushing them. Their nature is to rotate in that way. So if it's not a mechanical explanation that's needed, what we want to look for is a deeper philosophical, metaphysical explanation that's required. And here, I think it's important to go back to Aristotle's physics. As Thomas is working on the five ways, he's working on commentaries on Aristotle's physics and metaphysics. And so it's very much forefront in his mind. And if you go back to the earlier part of the physics book four especially, we get this idea that time is a dependent phenomenon. Time is the measurement of change. Time doesn't pass unless change happens, right? So that immediately raises the question of, well, how then do we explain the passage of time itself? Why does time itself move forward? It can only move forward if change is happening, right? But then what causes the change that moves time forward, right? That's where you need something that's acting simultaneously. So to go back to inertia, right? Inertia is a time-dependent phenomenon. A body will move inertially in the sense that as time passes, we can predict exactly where it's going to be in space. As time passes, it sort of pulls the inertial body along through space. So inertia is time-dependent. But time is change-dependent. Right? Time itself is a dependent phenomenon. So inertia depends on time. Time depends on change, right? So inertia cannot be the explanation of the continuity of change. It's rather there's some kind of continuity of change that occurs that drives time forward and therefore pulls things along inertially, right? And this is true in Aristotle's mechanics and also in Newton's and in Einstein's. It's been a constant kind of theme here that you have to explain the progression of time itself. And that also solves another problem, right? Which is the other main objection to the first way. This goes way back to Suarez, at least, maybe earlier, is, well, at least, at most, it gets you some kind of physical, cosmological, unmoved mover so far from God that it's hardly worth bothering with. But if we look at it this way, that the first mover is explaining the passage of time, then the first mover has to be outside of time. Because if the first mover were inside time, then we'd have to keep changing in order to be responsible for the progress of time. But that means that something else would have to be moving the first mover along, so to speak, in time. So the only thing that could possibly explain the progress of time itself has got to be something supertemporal, something extratemporal, right? And to be extratemporal, you'd have to be not just unchanging, but beyond all possibility of change, right? Because if you're capable of change, then you're really in time, even if you're not actually changing, right? So that a timeless thing would have to be something outside of the possibility of change, and that would be a being of pure actuality, to use Aristotle's notion, a being that is necessarily everything it could possibly be. And so that gets you much closer to God, right? It doesn't get you all the way, but it gets you a long way towards the end.
That's right. And we find that with a lot of these ways. It's not just a first mover, an unmoved mover. It's an unmovable, unchangeable mover.
Yeah.
And in the second way, similarly, it's not just an uncaused cause, it's an uncausable cause. And so in each case, you really can't end up with anything inside the natural world that serves that role. It has to be something supernatural. And eventually you get, I think, to the conclusion that it is a perfect God. But it takes a while to get there. You don't have all of that argument in the first way or in the second way.
Yeah.
But already the key moves are set up for you.
When Thomas says at each end of each way is an element called this God, we don't think he means, oh, I've now established all the divine attributes, right? I'm not basically finished. I've now got an independent basis for all of natural theology. I think all he's saying is we've now established the existence of something under a description, which in fact only applies to God. So in fact, God is the only being totally outside of time. And so once we've established that, we've established a being that we could call God. Likewise, the second way, we get a being that's uncausable. Only God is uncausable. So again, that's God. We haven't shown that he's omnipotent and all the other things yet, but we've established a characteristic, the existence of a thing with a certain characteristic, which in fact is unique to God. And that's the kind of justifies those claims.
So then thinking about them in terms of a kind of underlying or operative natural philosophy and metaphysics, depending upon how one draws a formal distinction between those disciplines, are we talking here like the red thread through the five ways is act and potency, like we're remoting potency in each instance, or is it something more refined than that?
It certainly plays a crucial role in, I guess, all five of the ways, doesn't it? I mean, not surprisingly. So I mean, one thing we could say here, of course, is that we're not claiming that the five ways are absolutely irresistible proofs that no one would avoid. They all do presuppose certain broadly Aristotelian ideas, including this distinction between actuality and potentiality. And I mentioned earlier, you know, time is the measure of change and things like that. So they're very defensible things and things that plausibly claim to be self-evident, but not necessarily uncontroversial. That's a further step for sure.
And then do you find that in reading the five ways as a kind of like suite of arguments or ensemble of arguments, but a series of arguments to be read together, at the very least in the aggregate, perhaps at most as integral parts in one overall argument, that there are kind of advantages to that, or there are certain things that emerge from the text which might not otherwise be visible or perceptible to the casual reader?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we could work backwards from the fifth way for a minute, just that, if you don't mind. So,
sure. So
we actually think the fourth and fifth way are dependent on the first three. So they aren't additional reasons for believing in a first cause. They're rather in making a move from a first cause, an uncausable cause, to some characteristic. So in the case of the fourth way, to perfect being. In the case of the fifth way, to intelligence. So if you look at the fifth way, I mean, there is a kind of parallel to the fifth way in the Summa Contra Gentiles, and the parallel there at the end of book 13, that's explicitly a design argument. He talks about the order of the universe, the harmony, and so on. None of that's in the fifth way, right?
Yeah.
So we think we came to this originally thinking the five ways were a kind of reader's digest of the stuff in the Summa Contra Gentiles. So that's where you would find all the details. But as we looked at it, we realized, no, actually, these are quite different arguments and better arguments than the Summa Contra Gentiles. So SCG is our kind of the rough draft. If you do metaphysics, you know this. When you first start working an argument, you end up this really complicated thing with lots of problems, and you gradually figure out what you're really getting at, and you get this simpler and simpler and cleaner argument. I think that's what's happened to Thomas. The five ways are this really vastly improved, simpler, cleaner, more economical sort of argument. And in the case of the fifth way, we pretty much abandon any kind of design argument, appeal to the cosmos, and so on. It's really just a question of what would an uncausable being be like? Could it be unintelligent? Well, to be unintelligent, right, it would have to have something else giving it its end, something else giving it its purpose, right? That's because unintelligent things can't give themselves a purpose, right? They get a nature from something else that orders them in a certain way. So the first cause, if it were unintelligent, it would have to receive its end from something else, but then it wouldn't be the first cause anymore. So therefore, the only kind of thing that could be an uncausable first cause would be something that could give itself its end. And it can only do that by being intelligent, ultimately by seeing what's good, and then just choosing something that's good for the sake of the goodness and not being directed to that end by something else. It has to be autonomous, in other words. Only an autonomous being could be a first cause, right? So that's, we think that's really the point of the fifth way, right? And no one else has ever, I think, argued this way, but there's parallel passages actually in the Summa Contradictiles later where he does explicitly say this sort of thing. And we think this really illuminates what's going on in the fifth way. And likewise, in the fourth way, as Dan mentioned earlier, if you look to the passage in Aristotle's Alpha the Lesser in the Metaphysics that he explicitly refers to, Aristotle clearly there says that if something is the first cause of everything in a genus, the cause of everything in a genus, then it's the greatest in the genus. He argues from cause to greatest. He doesn't argue from greatest to first cause. Right? So the fourth way is not about trying to prove first that God's the greatest in all being and then establishing that he causes other things. That would be a very Platonic way of thinking about it, not the way that Aristotle or Thomas would be likely to do. It's rather, given that there's a first cause of being, which we established in the first three ways, that thing must be in some sense the greatest in being. So that's the force of the fourth way. It's a very non-Platonic, I think, way of understanding the fourth way that fits better to Thomas's general strategy.
So that particular interpretative knot was part of my research, because, you know, people will refer in the secondary literature to, you know, the ascending dialectic and the descending dialectic.
Right.
And there's a master of the order, of the Dominican order, named Vincent de Cunongle, who wrote two articles on this theme before he was the master of the order and had his life devoured by administrative affairs. But like, it's an interesting exercise too in setting the text, appreciating St. Thomas's interpretive move, and then recognizing that it wasn't because of country bumpkinism, but it was like a deliberate move, which he held to be metaphysically, not like merely probable, but coherent. But yeah, I just find that fascinating. This notion that the utmost is causal, because it has cool soteriological implications. So I'm glad that Christ is utmost in various ways, because it means there's hope for us. So then if these arguments are as you describe them, then is the word via being deployed analogically, or would you say it's still univocal, but it requires us to kind of touch up what we mean by way, kind of like via ad existentiam Dei? Is that still operative there in the fourth and the fifth way?
Yeah. I think we don't want to overinterpret the idea of way, again, as if these are five independent paths. I think you can think of ways as being sequential as well as in parallel.
Right. I think of it in terms of a long road trip. Mm-hmm. You take this route, then you have to take that one, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. They're in a sense independent roads, but they're also getting there depends on using all of them in the right order.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. And then, so if those ways are dependent upon the first three ways, or at least, I suppose dependent is a potentially ambivalent term, but if those ways presuppose to or consequent upon the first three ways, then what else needs to be sussed out in the second and the third way in order for the aforementioned suite or ensemble of arguments to obtain in the way in which St. Thomas understands it to obtain?
Yeah. So one thing that we do in the first three ways is we do insist that each way stay in its own lane, so to speak. So the first way is about time and change. That means the second and third way are not about time and change at all. And that there we differ from almost every other interpretation, right, that interprets both second and third involving time in some way. So in the second way, people typically interpret it in terms of we need a cause to explain the conservation of things in existence at each moment. Right? And the reason for that, of course, is that Thomas and Aristotle thought it was at least metaphysically possible for the past to be infinite. And so it looks like you could have an infinite regress going back into the past. So why do you need a first cause? And so the typical move is, well, you need it to cause things to exist now, right? Well, we think that's a bad interpretation for several reasons. One is it's pretty unobvious. And secondly, Thomas himself, although he does believe that, he doesn't actually argue for it until you get to question 104, 102 questions later in the first part. So it'd be very odd if he's assuming something in the second way that he doesn't get around to proving until question 104 in the first part. So what we do is we look at how he uses the idea in other places of a distinction between these two kinds of infinite regresses, the bad kind, the per se that can't happen, and the okay kind, per accidens kind that can. And it's very clear in Thomas that the per se and per accidens there, essential and accidental, apply to the term infinity. So there's some kind of regresses that are essentially infinite, and those are bad. Those can't happen. And then there's those that are essentially finite or just accidentally infinite. Those are possible. And the reason that they're possible is that if something's only accidentally infinite, then it's really finite. You can sort of glom it together in such a way that it's really a finite sequence, and then you're forced to find first cause. And so I think that's the right way to interpret the second way, that it's about finding the cause of the existence of the universe. We don't have to talk about time. Just why is there this world of causable things? It has to be itself only accidentally infinite, if at all. And so there has to be a cause of existence itself. So the first way contributes to the second way, because the first way establishes that there could at least be, in fact, there probably is, a being outside of time. And so we can really understand the second way then in terms of this non-temporal causation of existence, but it's non-temporally causing the universe, which is this causable thing, to exist. And then the third way, maybe I'll let Dan talk about this, because this is how the book sort of came into part. I had this new interpretation of the first way, and then I ran it down, and he's got this really new interpretation of the third way. I said, well, okay, let's put this together, and let's think about these other three ways. And sure enough, we came up with new interpretations of them as well. And in each case, I think, advancing the understanding in significant ways. So why don't you say something about the third way?
Yeah, the third way is routinely understood as being about time, that basically if a contingent thing, something that could exist or could fail to exist, if it's contingent, there must have been some time, which it's not. And if everything were contingent, there would be a time when there was nothing. But if there was a time when there was nothing at all, there would be nothing now. So yeah, not
that time was in the past, even.
Yeah, right. Why? I mean, why assume, first of all, that there would be such a time where nothing existed? Then why assume it happened in the past instead of, you know, some distant future?
Right.
And so it doesn't make much sense that way. It looks like a terrible argument. And the consensus in much of the scholarly literature is, yes, it's a terrible argument.
Even most Thomists think it's a pretty bad argument.
That's right. But I don't think that's what's going on at all. For one thing, he never uses the word time throughout this entire thing. So here's a case of really misleading translation. But if you look carefully at the words that could be given a temporal interpretation, he uses those throughout his corpus in other ways that suggest something modal, about possibility, not about time. And so once you recognize that, you realize, oh, wait a minute, he's saying that, first of all, if everything were contingent, then it would be possible for any given thing or many or any independent group of things not to exist. And if that's true, then we advance what we call a subtraction principle, saying, look, if there are independent things that could fail to exist, then their existence doesn't depend on the non-existence of something else. They could be subtracted without adding anything to the universe. And you could basically trace things back on these chains of dependence to the things that are fundamental, are independent, and then subtract them. You'd be left with nothing. But he's talking about not some time in the past where that would have happened. He's talking about a possible world, a possibility where that would have happened. And then the argument goes, once you're even in a possible situation where that would happen, there's no way to get out of it. Nothing else would be possible because you've got nothing to cause any change there, nothing to cause anything to exist. So any world where there was nothing at all would be just a world that had no possibilities at all. It would just be stuck there. But then the argument goes, then how could our world exist? If there were such a world where there could be nothing at all, then there would be nothing in any world because nothing would be possible from the point of view of that world. There is a background assumption that possibility is the same in all these worlds. If something's contingent, it's necessarily contingent. And so the conclusion isn't, if there had been a time in the past, there would be nothing now, but obviously there is. Instead, it's, if there were even a possible world where nothing existed, then there would be no possible world in which anything existed. But that's right. Obviously wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so I am one of these kind of old-time co-religionists. No, that's a bad pun. I don't know much in the way of contemporary philosophy, and so possible world language makes me feel ever so slightly uncomfortable insofar as anything alien, foreign, makes me feel ever so slightly uncomfortable. More judgment on me than on the actual subject matter. But could you advance that argument without reference to possible worlds, just kind of along the lines of the kind of hypothetical impossible, the like ex hypothesi per impossibile that St. Thomas would deploy in his own setting?
Yes, absolutely. It's having been trained in contemporary techniques, it's easiest for me to express it.
Sure, yeah.
But you could just think in terms of possible states of affairs, or situations, or hypotheticals. If there were even a hypothetical case where nothing existed, then nothing could ever exist anywhere. So nothing would actually exist. In fact, one of the words that is interpreted temporally by a lot of people, modo, which can mean now, even though that's not its standard meaning, it doesn't mean now here, it means actually. If there could be a situation where there was nothing, then there would be nothing in actuality. There would be nothing here. And so I think that possible worlds talk makes it easier to think about in a way, but it's not essential to the argument. What's really essential is thinking, wait, if everything were contingent, it would be possible to subtract all the independent things. But if you've got all the independent things, all the dependent things fall too, there would be some possible circumstance, there would be a meaningful hypothetical in which there would be nothing. But once, if that were real, if that were a real possibility, then nothing could ever exist.
Yeah. It's just thinking about the third way and the fourth way of use as you have described them, you get a kind of picture, an emergent picture of like God and the fecundity of divine being, and a kind of metaphysics of creation, which emerges on the basis of the understanding that you have approximated, approached, attained to argumentatively in the range of, you know, like that it is. So it seems like already in these arguments you have, you know, so you're answering the question whether it is, but in answering the question whether it is, you're beginning to answer the question what it is, or at least a lot of the principles which will subsequently be teased out in argument, thinking here in the Summa Theologiae, like especially questions 3 through 11, are on offer. So can you speak a little bit to that phenomenon as to the image of God or the portrait of God that begins to emerge on the basis of the five ways as you've interpreted them and then as you've explained them in novel fashion?
Yeah, so in the book, we're going to go beyond the five ways. Actually, we're going to go into the following questions in dealing with simplicity, perfection, infinity, and intelligence, unity and intelligence, those five things, right?
Nice.
And for us, our interpretation, I think I don't want to do anybody's interpretation, for Thomas, the idea of simplicity is central. So The connection between that and the five ways, we think, is that the five ways, especially the first, second, and third way, are about getting to a being that is uncausable and independent. Absolutely independent in the third way. And Thomas argues that to get something that's truly uncausable and independent, you'd have to get something whose essence is identical to its existence. So we go ahead and embrace that. That's the most heavy duty metaphysics, right, of the whole book. And we're trying to defend that view from a point of view of, again, contemporary metaphysics. Suggesting that what Thomas has in mind here is an interesting theory about what actuality consists in, that for something to be actual is for some kind of act of existence, this entity, to be added to its possibility in order to make it actual. So, and we give some defense we argue that's a defensible account of actuality. And then in connection with the first three ways, we can see, well, the only way you could get something that's truly uncausable would be if Thomas's account of actuality is right, and if among the beings in the world there's a being which is simply identical to an act of existence. Isn't an act of existence added to something else, but is just pure existence per se. And so that, I think that's the key idea in Thomas, and then everything else about God really follows from that, from God's being identical to a simple act of existence, right? Unqualified, unlimited existence. That's what gets you then perfection, infinity, and all the other characteristics. And we're going to work on the last chapter. We're going to do some quick comparisons and argue that this strategy of Thomas is superior to the others that are on offer. I mean, Scotus, I think, for instance, would go to infinity first rather than simplicity. So the first cause is uncausable because it's infinite, right? But then the problem is, well, why couldn't one infinite thing cause another infinite thing? Right? Not, and in any case, Scotus is relying heavily on some kind of principle of proportionality that we think Thomas doesn't actually need, that he doesn't need this idea that the cause has to be greater than the effect in every case. At least not in the context of the five ways. So I think it's a defensible and I think very fruitful approach that Thomas has.
Maybe for one last question, I'm just interested to adopt an historical tack. You made the observation earlier that the arguments that St. Thomas applies here in the Summa Theologiae outstrip those that he supplies in the Summa Contra Gentiles, because those in the Contra Gentiles are typically longer. People will often source them for the types of details which St. Thomas will adumbrate in the Summa Theologiae. So you've got like a renewed appreciation in the last 50 years for certain historical developments within St. Thomas's thought. I'm thinking of people like John Whipple or Jean-Pierre Terrell. And so you have the Summa Contra Gentiles often dated to like 1259 to 1265, insofar as those arguments occur in Book 1, they're going to be relatively early, shortly after St. Thomas finishes, like, you know, his sentences commentary is finished in 1256, his De Veritate, you know, disputed questions is done in like 1259, so this is early on. And then I think people will date the writing of the Summa Theologiae to like 1266 to 1273, so you've at least got, you know, a life cycle of St. Thomas's relatively short career. This idea of like the kind of metaphysics of essay is one thing that 20th century scholars have identified as like a novelty in his work. Do you identify other things that like St. Thomas will have picked up along the way, or things that he appreciates with greater urgency or intensity in these later formulations of arguments for the existence of God, which really give it teeth, or which, you know, like really give it the strength that you're kind of appreciating in your critical reception?
Well, I mentioned the first way, especially in this context. So in the Summa Contra Gentiles, book one, question, chapter 13, it's a long discussion, right, of a whole set of arguments that Aristotle gives in the physics. They're very complicated and full of very dubious premises. And I think what Thomas has realized by the time he's writing the Summa Theologiae is, wait, there's a more fundamental idea here, right? Which we can just grab hold of, and I think that you end up with just a much better argument in the end than what you had in the Summa Contra Gentiles.
Yeah, and I think it's not only a much cleaner and stronger argument, avoiding a lot of those premises, but it's much more directly geared against a possible objection, which is advanced by Anthony Kenny and some others against a variety of the ways, which is that, look, this first mover, first cause, whatever it is, it may just be a natural thing. It may simply be the Big Bang or something of that sort that fits into the natural world. And given certain interpretations of the argument, and even given the arguments in the Summa Contra Gentiles, I think, yeah, you could have that view. That's a reasonable objection. But I don't think it works at all against the ones in the Summa Theologiae. There, it's pretty clear this thing has to be outside of time. It cannot be part of the natural world. And it has to be not only uncaused, but uncausable. So it can't be something like the Big Bang or some other kind of naturalistic force, energy field or something like that. Yeah. It's got to be something that has the properties of God.
Yeah. And then there's nothing in the Summa Contra Gentiles that corresponds to the third way. That's right. That's a completely original argument there. And I think it's a really important one if you properly understood. It gets you to a being that is not only necessary, but necessary in itself, necessary by itself, which is what the second part of the third way does. That again advances us long ways towards the ultimate simplicity thesis that he's going to develop.
That's right. If God weren't simple, if this act of existence were different from God's essence, there would have to be an explanation for why that essence happens to exist. But then you'd be pushed toward God dependent, like being dependent on something else, being caused by something else, etc. So all of the structure of the first three ways would fall apart.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's that uncausability idea that you find in all three of those first three ways.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. That's helpful for me to think about these things from a different vantage, to think about these things in with a fresh perspective. So while the book itself has not yet been published yet, its readers in the metaphorical sense of reading, I guess it's analogical. I mean, read, words, concepts, it's something like reading what we're doing right now. Have already begun to profit. So thanks.
Great. Our pleasure.
Yeah. So as we kind of wind up, how might folks kind of follow up with your work? What are typical ways or typical avenues that they can explore to learn more?
Well, I've got a website. I don't know if you probably do too, right? robkunz.net. I've got a lot of my papers there. I've also got to try to keep a blog going where a lot of the ideas will appear periodically. You can find that on the same website.
Right. I have a website, philosophical.space. But also I have a YouTube channel where I have 85,000 subscribers and hundreds of videos on all sorts of philosophical topics, including some of my first thoughts about the five ways. But those videos are several years old, so I can do now much, much better ones.
Yeah. Dan's one of the biggest presences in YouTube world and philosophy, so he's a real asset.
That's all. And something I think that like a lot of, I don't know, I can speak for the theological community, but theologians struggle with is it's like, sometimes you feel like you're sussing out your own ideas and you're kind of sussing them out alone. But I think that the philosophical community, especially amongst believers, does a better job of, kind of talking through things. Like the ACPA is pretty cool in that regard. I mean, the Sacra Doctrina Project as of late has been really good in hosting substantive conversations and getting to resolutions. And that's something that excites me for. What would you say? Dialogue is a kind of dirty word in certain reactionary circles, but conversation, conversation going forward. So kudos.
Yeah, I think in philosophy and in religion and in theology, there is increasing interaction. The number of Christian philosophers seems to me to be growing, and the extent to which the community in Catholic and non-Catholic circles is actually taking theological ideas seriously has greatly expanded. So I see it as a growth area, and it's a wonderful thing after, a century.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again. And I look forward to my next visit to the University of Texas at Austin. So I can, what did I do then when I was there the last time? Chatted with interesting people, drank boba tea, and talked mystic metaphysics. So what else is there in life? All right, turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, unless it is contrary to your academic advancement or spiritual growth, and then promptly unsubscribe/run to the hills, buy yourself 3 acres and a cow, and do what feels right. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.